Happy Tuesday, and welcome to this conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and today I'm not in the studio, so we'll be doing things a little differently. And if you've discovered anything about me over the last few years, or you've been following the show for a while, you know that I love road trips, eclectic events, and I love conversations with unique and interesting people. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things, or well-known people talking about subjects outside of their public persona. So to get in the spirit of my summer adventures, and hopefully your summer adventures, I'm happy to share with you a show from the road. These conversations today all took place last year at the Live Oak Music Festival. I start off with the Americana folk group, Birds of Chicago, and their founders J.T. Nero and Allison Russell. And then I'll also be speaking with Raul Pacheco from the world beat-influenced Ozomatli. And none of these conversations had an agenda or a particular theme other than what does music bring to your life? These conversations covered a wide range of topics from love, marriage, family, and social justice. So although we won't be opening up the phone lines today, you can still be a part of the conversation. You can share your thoughts about the program by visiting our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also listen to previous shows or share one of your favorites with someone else by visiting kcbx.org and clicking on the All Programs tab. There you'll find years of our shows that are updated regularly. And you can also podcast by subscribing at Apple Podcasts or however you find your podcast and search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And so to kick off today's show, I sat down with the married founders of Birds of Chicago, J.T. Nero and Allison Russell, who talked about their journey, both solo and together, and how they make life on the road and family work. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
This beautiful morning till it's gone. God bless this beautiful morning till it's gone. How I'm gonna feel when it goes, I don't know. That's another song. God bless this beautiful morning till it's gone.
There's so much emotion that comes in your voice and while you're even telling the stories. And so let's start off, Holly, what brought you to music and what does it do for you?
Well, I guess music has always been a part of my life. I come from a fairly musical family, but what really brought me to it was running away from home, I guess, when I was about 15. I had not a great home situation, an abusive situation, and I had to leave. And I was very lucky to fall in with a group of people who were creative and making music and who welcomed me and encouraged me in that way. And so that music became my outlet and, it sounds extreme, but sort of my salvation. I've been writing and playing and singing and collaborating with people ever since then.
And so how long have you been doing this work professionally?
I started my first paid gig as a musician was I moved from Montreal to Vancouver when I was 17, and I got hired by the NDP, the New Democratic Party of British Columbia, to sing the national anthem, Canadian national anthem, for their for one of their conferences, because I was bilingual, so I could sing it in French and English. And I got paid $350, and I just thought, oh my goodness, I want to do this for the rest of my life. And then I got hired to translate some lyrics into French and play with a group of older gentlemen who were kind of doing like a Django Reinhardt cover band called the Hot Club of Mars. And I played some festivals with them. And after that experience, I just thought I want to figure out a way to do this for the rest of my life.
Make it your thing. So JT, what brought you to music and what has it brought to your life?
You know, I come from a family of writers and English teachers. So I was lucky in the basic sense of my family always saw writing and words as both art and a craft. Like, I didn't have to go through some big crisis, you know, when I made the decision that I wanted to live by my words. Mm-hmm. So that I always wrote poetry, and in some point in my early 20s, it shifted over to songwriting, and you know, in a general sense, I've been doing that long enough now that it's sort of as vital to my daily functioning in the world as any of the other vital things you can think of. Like, it's my bread and water, you know? You can take that for granted. You can take that for anything that you do every day for granted. But there are times when something, you know, particularly something rocks you, something traumatic, something, and where I'm reminded of how kind of blessed and lucky I am to be able to take something that might be particularly destructive, you know, to your psyche, your soul, otherwise, and turn it into something literally that you feel in all senses of the word, good about, you know. And that's the conversion, and that's the amazing thing. So I don't know what I'd do without it.
I love the term conversion, because I think that's something that people don't ever pay attention to. They think if they're depressed or anxious or have a trauma that it becomes stuck in them. But the whole idea is moving that energy to converting it to something so you can move on. And so it sounds like writing gives you that vehicle.
Yeah, I think there's a basic thing with mental health, with spiritual health, that most, I mean, I'm no expert, but my general sense of things is so much of the disturbed, the fractured health on those fronts comes from the amount of energy that we use to sort of tamp things down or to siphon it off by, and the act of songwriting and that kind of outlet, you know, it allows you to do the opposite of that. You know, you're dealing with the things, and they're being transformed, and they're and it sort of allows you to do it in a way that doesn't have some of the other baggage associated sometimes that people have trouble with, like therapy, or, you know, they kind of become loaded words, but that's exactly what it is.
It is therapeutic, know? Absolutely. It's therapeutic, and it's therapeutic to play music, and it literally changes your biochemistry. I know mm-hmm. there's a lot of research on that front now. I'm not au courant with exactly what's been, but there's, you know, music literally changes brain chemistry, and I feel that, you know, I feel that when we play with people, it's the thing I'm totally hooked on and will do till the day I die, whether it's professionally the entire time or not. It's just that playing with other people and singing and sharing that with a group of sympathetic listeners where you feel like there's an exchange and a communion that occurs. It's, for me, very spiritual experience as well, and it's sustaining in that way.
And so you're a married couple.
Yeah.
So what brought you together in your music, and what is it like sharing both the intimacy of a marriage and the intimacy of music? Who wants to jump in?
Do you want to separate us?
Yes, different rooms, and we'll see how the answers play out. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I can say that music was the attraction first.
And we're friends first. And
we spent a kind of comical year or so trying to pretend that the romance thing wasn't happening, and that we shouldn't let that get in the way of the music, and, you know.
So were you touring as a musical act during this?
Not together. So
okay,
we have... I play in a band called Po Girl as well.
I saw that.
And so I know JT because of a song. One of my bandmates in Po Girl had gone down to San Francisco and went to a kind of songwriters in the round night and met JT, who was living there at the time, and heard one of his songs, which is called Till It's Gone, which is one of my favorite songs in the world. And she came back to Vancouver with this song, and we were floored, started covering the song, and then, you know, I emailed him, I think, to ask permission.
You fangirled.
To ask permission. Yeah, it just is okay. We've been singing this song, and are you okay with that? We're going to record it, if that's okay with you. And he gave us permission, and we sort of became, our bands became friends. He had a band called JT and the Clouds, who, and all the clouds are now birds as well, but they were starting to get serious about their, you know, they were recording an album and doing a lot of shows, and they moved back from San Francisco back to Chicago, so they were doing shows there. They gave us our first American show. They invited us to open for them in Chicago, and we gave them their first Canadian shows opening for us. So we kind of, our bands became friends. We were kind of like brother sister bands.
And so it was almost like everyone's friends, and
yes,
then you're having this secret romance.
Yes, pretty much.
Well, I went on the road. I mean, Pogo was a pretty big deal there for a while, particularly in Europe. They had a really big European fan base, and they invited me to come open for them on a European tour solo, and Allie would come out and sing with me on my set, and so that was a time where it was like, looking back, it was so absurd,
comical,
like,
yeah,
a, you know, like full on kind of high school style, like creeping back from a hotel room, and we thought we were so slick.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
everyone's like, oh, gosh, like, you guys, please. Just,
it's like, are you guys kidding me?
Come out of the closet. Yeah.
So who was the first one to change the relationship status?
On Facebook, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that where all things become official?
We weren't even on Facebook back then. I didn't even know about it.
Who made it official? Who finally said, this is a thing?
God, I don't know. Was there?
I think that you, I was sort of, I had already come to the conclusion that the only person who could ever put up with a musician who toured as much as I do is another touring musician. So I was sort of, I think I had a vision of, no, this can work. It's not going to wreck the music. We'll still be friends even if it doesn't work out. And we'll always have this musical connection. I think the strength and the depth of our musical connection sort of gave me faith in that things would work out as they should. And even if we were to, you know, have a romantic relationship that didn't work out, that we would still have that musical connection because it predated the, mm-hmm, you know, the romantic. And I think, JT, you were at first, I think, more worried about just kind of messing it up, right?
And yeah, I think there were some layers to it. There was a bit of that. I was also coming off a pretty, like, toxic,
yes,
relationship.
Yes, he was heartbroken.
It maybe took me more of a second to wake up to what was, as we talk about, to pay attention to the, you know, the rivers that were, you know, running.
The energy that was
flowing. And there's that thing where it's like you're spending kind of absurd intellectual energy and to try to, like, talk yourself out of something that's already happening, you know?
It was a gradual where we just...
It happened on the road together.
Well, on the road, and also I made the choice in 2009 to actually move to Chicago, and I didn't move in with JT because I thought that would just be too heavy for us. We had been long distance for 3 years. You know, we were sort of courting 2006 through 2009 and long distance and doing lots of road dates, so we had spent very intensive time together. But when I moved to Chicago, I didn't want to just move in with him and have it be this heavy thing right away. So I moved, a mutual friend of ours, I moved in with her and we became roommates. And of course, he was over every night anyway, so
yeah,
it didn't, you know, we might as well. But it was great to have, our houses were about four blocks apart and we would, you know.
It was kind of romantic.
Yeah, it was romantic, yeah.
It was also
And that's when
really
it shifted, I think, to, okay, we are clearly a couple and we're doing this, you know.
It was also really dumb because we figured out, like, about 3 years later that we spent 3 years being on the road about, you know, 200 days of the year while paying on two apartments in Chicago.
Yeah.
Two apartments we were never in.
Not the wisest financial choice we ever made.
Sometimes you have to set up those things psychologically to ease yourself.
If it makes you feel better, though, statistically, your marriage has a 36% better chance of succeeding because you didn't cohabitate right off the bat. So
interesting. I did not know that.
You had some
that
inherent
stat.
Wisdom. It's a big. It's
That's
a big number.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating.
Because couples do what you were afraid of is that they move in without an intention.
Yeah.
And then when it doesn't start going right, what do you do with the dog that you have and who pays the lease? You did well. I give you the therapist blessing.
Thank you. Well, I feel thrilled. I'm very pleased with ourselves now.
It's a great moment. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a show from the road recorded backstage at the 2017 Live Oak Music Festival. I thought this was the perfect time to share these conversations as we gear up for the 2018 festival, celebrating 30 years of Live Oak. And we continue this conversation with the Birds of Chicago, J.T. Nero and Allison Russell, talking about music, family, and their life on the road. So then my other question is, now you've been doing this for a while as a married couple, how is it being intimate as a couple and having a business together? Does it?
Well, I mean, we should talk about, there's two layers of it. There was, you know, how was it being an intimate couple and having a business together
before
2013,
the baby.
December 30th, 2013, and then how has it all started to having
it's changed quite drastically with the advent of our daughter.
Let's just say that the challenges we thought we had before the kid all seem pretty laughable now.
Yes.
You know,
but it is.
I mean, I hope this isn't too cliche of an answer, but it is. The reason why we work, and it's also the greatest challenge. You know, we have to, we are able to do this job
that we love
because we do it together. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, because it takes so much of your time and your soul. I mean,
But
by the same token, sometimes we just have to, like, you know, we'll be like, you know, sniping at each other for like literally no reason, and we're like, oh wait, we literally haven't been out of each other's space in the last 72 hours. Maybe, you know, we're gonna separate.
Maybe I'll go for a run and you stay here and have a coffee.
You have a child, right? So someone has, so you have to navigate that piece.
We trade off with Ida, and we are very, very, very lucky to have a community of musicians and an amazing tour manager, Susie Bolter, who is married to our bass player, Chris Merrill, and is my dear, dear friend. She's been like the second mom to Ida. She's come on the road as our tour manager and watching Ida when we're on stage. And we're incredibly lucky to have a family of musicians whom we love, who love us and love our child and are helping to raise her. We have a village and we're not isolated and alone with her. So in some ways we're quite spoiled, I think, as new parents to have such an incredible support.
And it's unfortunate that you have to feel fortunate because up until, you know, our postmodern history,
that was normal. And it was much healthier because people go, it can go, the whole nuclear, hermetically sealed nuclear family model is really tough on everyone, I think.
It is, you know, so limiting, yes.
Yeah, very limiting. Both for the parents and the children, and there are times with the best will in the world where you're driving each other nuts and you just need to be, having someone scoop in and take your child can mean the difference between, you know,
being in an abusive home.
Exactly, or not. Right. Exactly.
And I'm sure you're sensitized to that.
Very aware.
Needing
that
outlet.
I was terrified to become a mother because of how toxic of a situation I grew up in, and I just sort of thought I never want to pass that on, and I was afraid of it, I guess, and when it was a big surprise for us when we got pregnant, and we always thought eventually we would, but it was one of those, oh, in a year or two, and it's never the right time. And Ida just sort of took matters into her own hands. I'm coming, you sort yourselves out. And it was, JT was amazing because he was always just completely confident about it. And
how are you as a father? How has this changed you? That's why your marriage will work, because you're his fan.
Yeah.
I
had an awful experience that way, so I just have the opposite.
I mean, all the cliches are true. It's you don't you 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 just have no idea till you got one of your own, and it just, you know, just blows everything up in the best way. And you know, she blows our mind every day. So
has your songwriting changed? Like, have you become more wistful? Or
luckily I haven't written like 30 songs, syrupy songs about how great my daughter is.
I would think that that's all you'd want to do.
He wrote one really beautiful, syrupy, awesomely syrupy, in my opinion, song called Love Kills Shadows for Ida right when she was born. And I just love it. And he vowed to me, okay, that's the only obvious, you know, ode to our daughter that I'm going to write, because I can't just descend into that, like, only.
Yeah, we do have, we're root singers, so we have an obligation to keep it miserable, at least some of the time.
She informs everything that we do, you know. Yeah. She informs all of it. She's at the heart of it.
Yeah, I think it's, rather than, you know, people ask if, like, it changes your songwriting, and I don't know that it, other than, like, a couple of exceptions, changes content or anything. It just sort of throws everything in high relief. Everything feels more urgent. Everything feels more vivid. Everything feels, you know, you're just kind of on fire with all the, you know, I mean, sometimes, you know, not all in great way. I mean, sometimes you're terrified, you know, but all those kind of experiential things are heightened, you know, because it's not just about you anymore.
Right, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. There's something bigger than you, yeah. Pushing the, or pulling, yeah. I don't know which one it is.
Both, pushing and pulling. Yeah.
So my last question is there a holy grail for the birds of Chicago and for your family? Is there a place you're trying to kind of get to? And how will you know you've gotten there?
That's a really good and hard question, and something that we talk about a lot. And you know, what's our vision for the future? What's success?
Exactly.
We've arrived and we've
exactly.
made it. I mean, do you want to?
I mean, I will say this, that I think we're committed to, I mean, a big part of the vocation of music for us is playing shows live and traveling, and you know, music can be, it's an odd career in so many ways, because in some ways it, particularly at our level, where you have to be kind of engaged in the hands-on self-promotion aspect. So it can become very self-absorbed if you're not careful. And you have to, like, in playing live shows every night and doing what it takes physically to get yourself and have that communion that she talked about, like, that is the thing that sort of regrounds you every night of, like, in terms of why you do it. And so I think for us, even though we'll probably cut back some dates when Ida's in school, and, you know, keeping the show on the road and keeping that communion, that's like, really, to me, that's the, that is, that it's, that's a lifelong vocation. And you know, so we want it to grow, and we want to be able to keep a roof over our heads and send our kid to school. But for us, it's just every day kind of increasing that culture around the music a little bit. And and I mean, It is true in the true. I mean, it is the journey. If it's not the journey, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's probably true in any line of work, but man, in this line of work, it better be the journey.
Well, yeah, because they're, and I don't know if I ever expect people to say, oh, we're going to do this till we win an Emmy. Like, I don't know really what I think people are going to answer, but it seems to be kind of the same as long as we can provide for our family and still feel the joy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, provide for the family and feel the joy and be able to also have it be, it's one of the things that's important to me is to be able to, all of our musicians that we play with, for it to be sustainable for them too, you know. So that's kind of my, I have no dreams of fame or great riches. I just have dreams of sustainable
a little cottage industry around
cottage
your family
industry,
you know, like
sustainable cottage industry.
It's like your own family business.
Yes.
Well, and I would imagine, without knowing the whole story, but because of where you came from, I would imagine creating family and community's got to be big.
It's huge for me, and I feel so grateful and so lucky every day. And I think about the difference. My mom was 16 when she had me, and no support system, and no just. And I have an incredible partner who's completely present with our child and with me, and we're, you know, in this thing together and our whole community of friends. And yeah, I feel really grateful and really lucky. So
that's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank God for the kind of happiness you can't explain. Thank God for the kind of happiness you can't explain. By every right, late last night, should have bled into another bad day. Thank God for the kind of happiness you can't explain.
If you're just joining us, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to one of my shows from the road. We're not in the studio today taking calls, but you can still share your thoughts about the program by visiting our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or sending an email to me, elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. We just heard from J.T. Nero and Allison Russell, married founders of Birds of Chicago, an Americana folk group, whom I chatted with backstage at last year's Live Oak Music Festival. And so to get in the spirit of another great festival weekend, I have for you another conversation, this one with Raul Pacheco. He's an original member of the eclectic, multi-sound-influenced Ozo Motley from Los Angeles. This conversation was really difficult to edit down because we covered so many topics, but we're going to start off talking about the genesis of the band and their commitment to being advocates for social justice. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KCBX, and this is Raul Pacheco from Ozo Motley. And Raul, can you start off talking a little bit about Ozo Motley in general and the group's history? Just brief for people who don't know your work at all.
We're a band from Los Angeles that's been together for 22 years. We started at a labor protest, and I think, you know, the first things we used to do was just play for people to raise money and causes that we liked. And once we started playing shows in clubs and stuff, then, you know, it became like a real job. Mm-hmm. And we have 3 Grammys, we've traveled to 56 countries, we've been U.S. cultural ambassadors, and we're still playing music and still having fun.
So when you first started, I mean, let's even go back to growing up, did you grow up playing an instrument, thinking I'm going to be a musician someday?
I think music just made me happy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no one in my family was a musician, but there was a lot of music just like on a stereo being played in the house, and a lot of different styles of music. And I used to sing around the house. I was encouraged to join the school choir in elementary school. So I was in choir till, you know, right up until high school, and then I started playing guitar. But I never thought I was gonna be committed and do this until, you know, in my mid-20s, really.
So you didn't grow up with the rock star fantasy that a lot of people talk about?
Yeah, I had them. Okay. You know, I had them, and I think I made some bold decisions when I was young, too. I just was happy playing guitar, you know, and I did a few other things, and then I became, you know, kind of more politically motivated, and I went back to school to, I was studying political science. I was thinking about writing about California politics, especially like Chicano political history in the state, and maybe law school. I was working at campaigns, but every time I picked up the guitar, I was much happier. And so at one point, I guess I was about 25, I said, I think I got to just do this and not worry about anything else.
So what time in history, because you look so young, yeah. What was happening in LA at the time that you came through college, and what was happening in the Chicano community?
I mean, I don't think there was anything different that doesn't happen now. It's really, I think, most issues in the community where I'm from is mainly, you know, economic differences, racial differences, and in this country and in the world and in society in general, I think, you know, if you have money, you have a very different experience than if you don't. And if you are not the racial makeup of the dominant culture, you have a very different experience than if you are. So I don't think it's any different than when I grew up. And
is that a frustrating thing to realize that things aren't any different, or does it feel like there's any movement?
Yeah, I think there's always a movement where I'm at. And I think there's always a movement around the world if you want to get into issues that where you want to create momentum over certain things. But I think I'm very different in my experience. I have found because I had a lot of experience. I had a lot of experience outside of the community since I was young. I was in a boys' choir from the age of 8 to 14 that exposed me to all different kinds of kids, all different kinds of economic backgrounds, all different kinds of experiences in LA, which is I'm very grateful for that because it allowed me to go to a place like high school. I went to high school called Thatcher in Ojai.
How did that come about? Was it a scholarship or your parents knew about it? Essentially,
you know, I had a teacher who, Mr. Mitchell, yeah, and and he just thought, you know, that I think one of his contributions was, you know, you need to get out of this community and to experience something different. And I don't think it was from a place of like, you know, your community's bad. I think every kid needs to get out of their community.
Absolutely.
I think that's one of the issues and one of the reasons why there's a lot of conflict, because it's difficult for us to have empathy and to have an understanding of another and to be kind of basically human with one another when we see the basic difference as rich as, oh, that's bad or that's good or something. It's like, oh, I can't go to that neighborhood because, mm-hmm. Yes, you can. Yes, and I'm lucky that I've had these experiences because I'm a Chicano from Boyle Heights who goes anywhere I want. And when I meet kids where I grew up and I say, you can, or anybody who has those feelings for any reason, you can go anywhere you want. But there is a different language and there is a different set of way people communicate in these different spaces. There's different identities in these spaces. But they're attainable and in any forum. And I think just like someone who's feels like a foreigner, it helps when you learn a little bit about where you're at.
So this is not where I was going to go, but it just made me think of this question. Yeah. So you said, you know, I'm a Chicano from Boyle Heights and I can go anywhere, but as a Caucasian woman from, you know, San Luis Obispo, can I go anywhere? I mean,
it's on you. That's my whole thing. And I think, and what I'm saying in terms of what you're saying is that if you wanted to go there with a different type of experience or a different type of, or if you wanted to be welcome, then maybe you should know a little bit. Maybe you should know what's happening there. Because I shouldn't go to another neighborhood and just throw myself around in a way that's disrespectful. So what I say in terms of I can go anywhere,
right.
I do need to have a level of understanding of, you know, how do I want to make an impression? Do I want to be a jerk? You know, because I go anywhere and be a jerk, or do I want to go somewhere and have a understanding of what the norms are? There's all levels of it. So I'm just expressing what my and how I do it, because I do think everybody can go anywhere, and they should if they want.
So going back to Ozamotli when you started out, so early 90s then?
Mid-90s, yeah.
Mid-90s. So how did you, because you've had different formations of the group, different numbers of people. So is there a core, and how did you guys come together?
Well, we're the six guys who are in the band now, which is the smallest version of the band over the past few years. They're all original guys. So we're the ones who just stuck around. And I mean, in the beginning, it was pretty much whoever showed up. It was a jam, there would be 15 people on stage.
Really?
Yeah, it was always different. We were the guys who just kept showing up. And with all the changes we've been through with different members, with being like a 10-person band for many years, to whittling it down to now being six, you know, we feel like we carry the torch, and we don't have an issue with the shifts of it, because I think it is because we're all original guys.
Right.
You know, we feel kind of rooted in this experience, and it's our experience, and so I think it's nothing we have to debate about with people. Yeah.
So you said you start with doing social justice shows.
Yeah.
Was that Ozamotli, or with this group of guys, like? Was it this loose format? Hey, let's go to this. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but now, years later, kind of social justice seems to be at the forefront of.
For some of us, it wasn't that obvious. Oh, like we could, like you can actually, this is our volunteerism in a way.
Right.
So cool. You have a reason to charge $5 at the door or charge people for an event. And our vision has always been kind of you know, we met like 2 hours before, and it was like, what are you going to play? And it was like, what do you know? What do you know? What do you know? And that's why the sound was so eclectic, because it wasn't really so much about bass on. It wasn't a master plan. Right. It was like, I know some Mexican folk songs. The other guys are like, I've never played Mexican folk songs. What are we going to do? You know, and these are the chords. Just pick a beat. Okay, I can adjust. Like, that's how it happened. So, and that's kind of... And with the idea of rocking the party for these particular people. So, and I think we've always had that. We still have that. We still want to get up. We still want to rock the party. But there's the rocking the party is kind of, because in our opinion, because we all need it.
Yeah.
We all need a release. We all need to kind of celebrate. We all need to feel good. We all need to be some next to some stranger dancing.
Yeah.
You know, these are the things that, and if we're doing it in a form that maybe has a, it's because it's associated with a cause, I think it's much, you know, then people can maybe feel affirmed. But it's also, if people don't have that, maybe they can talk to one another, or maybe something that's going on we're going to talk about on stage, maybe there's something happening at an event that we support. It's we feel that we're just a part of kind of the momentum of all these things that happen, and we definitely on the sides of the have-nots, and definitely on the sides of every human, you know, has a space and has a right, and that we should all be affirmed in some ways.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about like social justice, yeah, and going out and kind of standing up for a cause, do you see Ozamotli as being a soundtrack in some way for...
Sure. I mean, I think we're a long line of bands and musicians that have made that a clear part of what they do. And
it seems like there's so many bands kind of shy away. Like, I don't feel there's that same Woody Guthrie.
I just think that's normal for people.
Right.
I don't think there's a lot of people on the forefront, on the picket lines, like, yeah, you know. So it's kind of the same thing. It's like there's a lot of different bands, and there's some of them who are committed to these things and are out there kind of talking about it or taking stands and for various reasons and causes. And I think we're just one of them, you know. And we bring something maybe that's kind of unique out of where we're from, our particular story, our individual makeup. We got like a Jewish guy, we got a Japanese guy, we got a, you know, a Creole guy. We got three Mexicans with different kinds of like shades of the diaspora of the Mexican experience. So I think that's what's unique about us. Yeah.
So when you look at your social justice, like the causes that are close to your heart, are there particular social justice causes that you as a group support, or is it each individual person saying, here's what I am about, let's support that? Like, how does that work as a group?
I think it's both. You know, sometimes we're actively part of a campaign. I mean, you know, I have done a lot of work at different levels on immigration issues. The band has also, over the years, there's been different things that we've done. We supported Bernie Sanders. We played on different rallies of his, and that was so much fun. And, you know, so I think it kind of just, we kind of fit into what we can do, because we don't, you know, sometimes we need to be home with our families.
Yeah.
And it's also just kind of what we want to do. I think for us, those causes, it's very important that we all agree. You know, and if some of us agree and some of us don't, it doesn't really work for us as a band. That doesn't serve us. So, and it's okay, you know. It's like we learned over the years that, you know, we have to feed this the momentum and kind of heart of this group, and we're all different. And if we move in agreement, it's much easier for us to be sincere, understand why we're doing things sometimes, and have fun, you know, doing it.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And as you can tell, we aren't in the studio today, but instead you're listening to the highlights of my conversation with Raul Pacheco from the band Ozamotli. They performed last year at the Live Oak Music Festival, and we're going to continue our conversation exploring the influence of masculinity, family, and music. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Well, and it sounds a little bit like a successful marriage. You know, they talk about the marriage has to be... its own entity, and the people in the marriage have to feed the entity. Is it kind of like that? Like the band is.
I think as men, you know, I think we grew up with each other. You know, it what makes it all unique. At the same time, it's like, well, you know, you're gonna have to make some mistakes, at least, and then, you know, and kind of understand tensions and understand what it means to be committed to something and understand what it means to how in our instance, you know, a experience of like any relationship, you know, really being into it, going and then going through a phase where you're not into each other. Mm-hmm. I think when you're younger, you have a tendency to, you know, be more about yourself, not see the whole picture, and then bust through that, and kind of we're like, man, I think we get along in a way that's really cool now, and it's we're very supportive of one another. We've all had personal issues, like everybody does, in our relationships with drugs and alcohol, with all sorts of stuff that we've helped each other get through. So that always feels really cool.
So you mentioned being a group of men, and I'm glad you went there, because the whole idea of masculinity in our culture today is on the forefront.
Yeah. I think the strange thing about being a man is that, and this is my opinion, is that you know, I think we need to be, there's these traditional roles of quote unquote strength or whatever, or, you know, providing or whatever, like all, and which I think come from, you know, a different era, but they're still very much here. And in my opinion, the new man is kind of like strong and all those things, but extremely sensitive at the same time. And it's that balance in us, it's very confusing because that is the message that we don't. There are not a lot of examples of that, but there are some. And it is becoming something that is easier and more common for men to even talk about and to, and I think part of it is the women, I mean, I don't know if it's the right thing to say, but I think women are better than men in many, you know, in so many ways that we have to kind of bow down and listen and understand things. And I think that, I think it's because we can't give birth.
Yeah. Well, you know? Women have traditionally in cultures been the keeper of birth and death, the great mysteries.
We can't create life.
No.
So there's this whole thing that's the major thing going on that we have no idea about. That we do not experience that. And it really, therefore, we don't truly understand it. We truly do not understand creation on that level. We truly do not. And so, you know, there's all sorts of things that we could come into to why we think the way we do. And I think that's basically it. And so having to, you know, having to kind of ask yourself, do you want to be a creator or a destroyer? And I think we're on the side of creators, but like everyone, we all make mistakes. I think, learning those aspects of expression that are destructive, and that could be for anybody, but I think within us as men, because we, in our specific group, because we have had issues with alcoholism, with drug, you know, all this stuff, that it's, you know, that kind of self-destruction, getting help for that, understanding that, trying to manage that in a different way, you know, for us as men, I think we're very supportive of being open to a different experience as a man. You know, I think we're lucky in that.
Well, and I think for a lot of time, our issue is that we've blocked men out of the experience of the feelings and emotions. You know, we got so rigid in the, your job is to provide and our job is to nurture. And then it just became, to talk about divides in our culture. I mean, we have a huge gender divide. And so it's almost like men are having to fight to bring that into their experience.
Like the fact that we're talking about this, you know what I mean? So there is, it is happening, but it, like you say, it is, there will always be these aspects of roles because it's naturally who we are, but like everything else, it needs to evolve. Yeah. And so, I think more and more it is, you know, but it's a slow process, just like political change and just like, societal change is a lifetime experience, you know, and being older, I can realize that now, and I'm glad that there's you know, revolutions start with young people, man, and that's a good thing, and that's why we need them, and that, and as you, you know, because they want change now.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a good, we need that energy. At the same time, me, I'm 48 years old. It's like, I see the big picture, like, whoa, like, I have to be fighting for this thing pretty much my whole life,
my life,
in order for it to, and create momentum. It probably, there's a lot of people, if I'm on this train, you will see a difference. But it's going to take 60, 70 years.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a show from the road recorded backstage at the 2017 Live Oak Music Festival. If you hadn't had music when you were 15, how do you think that would have...
I think for me, it's kind of what I was talking about before. It was that thing I was very lucky to have as a young person that I knew. I know not everybody does that. I think a lot of people do not until maybe later in life. And so it's always been easy for me to rely on this.
To fall back on.
Joy.
Right. So even when you were going through your own struggles, you had something that was your identity,
It was a motivation to get through difficult times. Mm-hmm. You know, when this band first started, my girlfriend became pregnant, and it's like, whoa. And I just saw, like, well, okay, how committed I am. So I just hustled and figured out ways to have enough money. You know, so she was at least taken care of, and that the baby was provided for, and that we were, you know, I tried my best to be together in a way, and it was very challenging in many ways. I mean, it was really difficult in many ways, you know, to be around for my children, you know, when they were young, and so, you know, and my own personal commitment to this is what helped me get through it and helped me to try to find ways to help my children and their mother, like, have some positive experience with it, you know? So I have children. I tell them it's important to have something that you love. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, it's important to not give up and to try things you've never tried. And I think if you, you know, if you feel lost in a sense, whatever that is, it, like, you know, almost embrace that.
Yeah. Well, and I would think too that the social justice piece, because when we look at mental health, you know, being connected to something bigger than our own problems, how do you see that playing out?
Well, for me, it feels good. Mm-hmm. It feels good to do something for other people. And I think if you've never done that, that may be something you should try, because it's not about, you know, people think that people who are activists are, if they're not, oh, they're so crazy or so weird or so, you know, loud or something. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to be that, but there is something, it's just their thing, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, and you talked about at the beginning with Boyle Heights and the community having its sense of resistance.
Yeah.
It almost, like, it transcends the individual's struggle and everyone feels united.
Well, there's a political history in that part of the city. You know, in the prior to the 40s, it was a very mixed community. It's a really interesting story. It was a place in Los Angeles that had no land covenants, which means that in certain parts of LA, like in other parts of the country, like in other parts of the world, if you were a certain race, you could not, or religion, you could not buy land there.
Yeah.
They had those laws in the
government
in the U.S. and people seem to forget that that wasn't that long ago. And that particular community had free land covenants. So there was African Americans, there was a large Jewish community, there was a Japanese, there was some Chinese, some Italians, Mexicans. You could own a house. So that was kind of, you know, there was this big street there, it was called Brooklyn Avenue, you know, because there was a lot of Jewish people there. And an incredible building still, really interesting part of Los Angeles. After World War II, primarily, primarily came a Mexican part of town. Jewish people left into the valley. There was kind of a different, there's still remnants of all that. And then there was a period in the 50s when they were building Los Angeles, and Boyle Heights is kind of boxed in by the most freeway in any part of the world.
Okay.
The most freeway miles.
Just like crossing and crisscrossing
There's a 710, the 5, the 10, the 110, the 60, and the 5.
And then Boyle Heights sits down in the...
It's right in the middle.
Okay.
And they went through a period of eminent domain where the city took their land and the county and the state and made the freeways. And it was that fight that created this political infrastructure. There was people who were, like, fighting and they lost. And that was, like, in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, what are we going to do now? And that became part of, in line what you were seeing in all over different parts of the country, with all these kinds of movements. And that was one that was right in line with all of it. And that became like the center of Chicano politics in I think the biggest probably movement in Southern California, although it was happening all over, but definitely in Los Angeles.
So when you talk about the social justice piece, and when you think about something that matters to you, is it from the perspective of your Chicano culture and heritage, or Boyle Heights, or the country in general? Like, what is it that gets to you? What issues drive you?
I mean, right now, I think immigration is an issue for me, and that's probably because I am of Mexican heritage, you know.
Is it Mexican heritage or Chicano? Because you said
There's different, you know. Chicano has its own kind of history and its own kind of birthing and reason, and in terms of terms, it is different than Mexican, but it's for the purpose of what we're talking about, it's really not that important.
Okay, just wanted to check.
But it is. There are differences in experience. Chicano is more like the Mexican diaspora.
Explain.
Like growing up, and where your primary culture is American.
Right.
You know, if I go to Mexico, it's very clear that I wasn't born there.
So but in Mexico, would you be considered a Chicano? And
I would be considered it depends. Some people might be, you're not really one of us. Some people would say that. And that's part of the experience of any immigrant, because in this country, we are, you know, in the images that you're seeing on TV and all these things, I'm also not one of these people.
Right.
That's how Chicano culture established itself, because there was enough Mexicans living in the U.S. having a very similar way of expressing themselves and developing their own culture and a unique kind of experience, to the point where, hey, but when I walk down this here neighborhood, I totally know where I'm at. I totally know this whole vibe. So we got to call it something, you know,
and it was having
that both in, you know, through the intellectual movement, through the street movement, where a lot of that culture kind of melded together, and that became identified as Chicano.
So back to what's driving you now that you're really feeling the heat for. You said immigration.
I think that's a huge issue right now, but I don't feel like a Mexican fighting for, you know, Mexicans, or Chicano fighting for Mexicans. I feel like a human fighting for other humans. You know, this is the particular place that is happening now. You know, I mentioned China earlier. It happens all over the world. You know, rural Chinese people get a 3-year visa to go work in the city because there's no work in the farmland.
Okay.
You know what? And when it's done, they don't go back. Where are they going to go? So they have all these, like, you know, kind of almost like slums or homeless people living on the outskirts of these giant cities. And where are they going to go? You know, and there's inter-country immigration issues, and it's like, whoa, you know. So as humans, this is what we do. We go to where we got to work. This is just what it is, and you know, it's these kind of economic units that are countries now that have always. It's always been that. There've been regions and this and that. And if I own this, you know, I'm the one who determines who comes in and who comes out. And
it's kind of what we're doing with cities, like gentrifying, right? Now you can't afford to live in my...
It's an economic, you know, thing. And it's... So it's... I just feel like it's an issue that, for me, that is what I bring, because I have an experience where I... That is tied to my culture specifically, I think. But I see it everywhere. I don't think it's uncommon in every part of the world. You have Africans trying to get here. You have other Asians trying to get here. You know, people need to survive.
Trying to make a life.
Yeah, basically.
So when you're doing your music, do you feel that Ozomatli brings a diverse mix of fans to your shows? Because the complaint sometimes of different festivals or different artists is that they only bring with them their cultural
group. You know, I think every festival is different. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons I'm lucky in this band is I get to be at all those different festivals. I get to play at a Latino salsa festival, can play at what people would call a hippie festival. I can play at a Chicano festival. I can play at, you know, I'm lucky that I get to do all that.
But is that unique to Ozomatli?
I think that it is unique to particular bands, and I think it is unique to us.
Thank you. You've been listening to another Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Ferret, and this show from the road was recorded backstage at the 2017 Live Oak Music Festival with performers Raul Pacheco from Ozo Motley and the Birds of Chicago co-founders J.T. Nero and Allison Russell. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen on demand at kcbx.org or subscribe to our podcast, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can also find me on our Facebook page or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I look forward to sharing more artist interviews in the coming weeks as we get ready for the 30th anniversary Live Oak Music Festival coming up over Father's Day weekend. Until then, thank you for listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Slaves.